Chapter 29, The Evidence of a Glorious Civilization.
You would think their hearts would have been humbled just a little after one quarter of the earth was annihilated by war, pestilence and famine and a horrible wild beast attack. But no. Not these people. Then you would expect at least a change of direction when the earth was burned up and the oceans destroyed. But no. Not these people. In fact, even after another one-third of the earth was annihilated and a horde of demons was unleashed upon them to torture them ruthlessly, they still wouldn't change their minds. And so it was these proud, arrogant, foolish people decided to do one of the dumbest things imaginable. They decided to take on God. You talk about stupid. The kings of the earth and the armies that were left actually took one last stand against their creator just outside of Jerusalem. They pointed their guns. They aimed their weapons. They stood in total defiance when all of a sudden, the Lamb of God ripped open the sky and millions upon millions of angels descended upon these rebels. This was no battle, it was a bloodbath. The wrath of God was poured out in full. So quick and so swift was their defeat that the leaders of the rebels were thrown alive into the lake of fire and the rest of them were squashed and popped like grapes in a winepress. In fact, the slaughter was so great that their blood flowed as high as 4 feet deep for 180 miles. The book is Revelation. The judgment, of course, is the Battle of Armageddon.
Now, folks, I don't know about you, but I'd say trying to start a war with God is probably one of the dumbest things you could ever do. You know what I'm saying? I mean, you talk about sin, you talk about rebellion. And people, here's the point. What was God's response to that? Did he hem-haw around? Was he worried? Did he sweat bullets wringing his hands hoping the people would leave him alone? Are you kidding me? Hello, he's God. He judged those people for the sin of rebellion. And so here's the point. You would think that people would stand up and take notice when God warns them about this future coming judgment, right? You would think that people would rightly conclude, hey man, I better get right with God so I don't suffer the coming judgment of God, right? But unfortunately, folks, as we've been seeing, that's no longer the case. Many people in our world today are not just having a hard time believing in God, but if there's one thing they absolutely refuse to believe in, it's in a future coming judgment of God. Therefore, in order to help these scoffing people hopefully become smarter people, we're going to continue in our study, The Witness of Creation. And what we're doing is taking a look at the five different evidences of creation that God has left behind for us, showing us that He's not just real, but that we really can have a personal, intimate relationship with the Creator of the universe, before it's too late. And so far we've seen the first evidence showing us this amazing truth is the evidence of an intelligent creation. The second evidence was the evidence of a young creation. The third evidence was the evidence of a special creation. And the last seven times we saw the fourth evidence was the evidence of a judged creation. And what we've been seeing is there really was a worldwide flood, i.e. a time when God judged this world because of sin, not just because the Bible says so, but as we saw last two times because the evidence of a gargantuan boat says so. And there we saw the evidences of the findings of Noah's Ark, the feasibility of Noah's Ark, and even the further questions surrounding the Ark that showed us beyond a shadow of a doubt, contrary to what the skeptics say, that there was a guy named Noah who really did make a big old giant boat and that he and his family really did survive on it with all the animals during a worldwide flood. That is, if you're honest with the facts. Oh, but that's not all. The seventh evidence of a judged creation is the evidence of a glorious civilization. But don't take my word for it. Let's listen to God's.
Genesis 4:16-22. So Cain went out from the Lord's presence and lived in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Cain lay with his wife, and she became pregnant and gave birth to Enoch. Cain was then building a city, and he named it after his son Enoch. To Enoch was born Irad, and Irad was the father of Mahujael, and Mahujael was the father of Methushael, and Methushael was the father of Lamech. Lamech married two women, one named Adah, and the other Zillah. Adah gave birth to Jabal, he was the father of those who live in tents and raise livestock. His brother's name was Jubal, he was the father of all who play the harp and flute. Zillah also had a son, Tuvalcain, who forged all kinds of tools out of bronze and iron. Tuvalcain's sister was Naamah.
Now folks, according to our text the Bible is clear. The pre-food civilization was not made up of ape-like creatures living in caves who dragged their knuckles on the ground grunting ooh ooh ah, alright? Are you kidding me? What did it say? They didn't live in caves, they built cities right out of the blue. On my best day, I couldn't even build a shed, let alone a city. But that's not all. What else did they make? One guy named Jubal got up one day and decided to invent music and musical instruments. Not play music, but invent music and the instruments to play it with right out of the blue. Another guy named Tuvalkine decides to invent metallurgy and start making complex metal alloys by separating them from various ores. People, I can't even separate the laundry, just ask my wife. And so here's my point. It's obvious according to the Bible, that the pre-flood civilization was a glorious one. These people weren't dumb apes dragging their knuckles. Evolution's got it wrong again. The Bible says these people were smart. Super smart. Much more intelligent and much more advanced than you and I could ever shake a stick at. And so that's the question. Do we find any evidence of a highly advanced pre-flood civilization, just like the Bible says? Of course. But don't take my word for it. Let's look at the evidence. The first evidence of a glorious pre-flood civilization is from advanced technology. People, we are going to take a look at the actual archaeological remains that totally blows away the evolutionary idea that man was a dumb ape-like creature who was dragging his knuckles in the past. In fact, they oftentimes label these finds as anomalies, which is basically saying, these discoveries do not fit our preconceived ideas of the supposed evolutionary origin of man. What you are going to see with your own eyes is that, just like the Bible says, man was very smart right from the start. In fact, so smart, that we are only now catching up to some of the advanced technology they invented and utilized long ago. Let's take a look. The first evidence of an advanced technology is ancient computers. Bill Gates, eat your heart out.
A perplexing artifact was recovered by sponge divers from a shipwreck in 1901 off the coast of Antikythera, a small island that lies northwest of Crete. The divers brought up from the wreck a great many marble and bronze statues that had apparently been the ship's cargo. Among the findings was a hunk of corroded bronze that contained some kind of mechanism composed of many gears and wheels and with writing on the case. An X-ray of the mechanism, however, revealed it to be far more complex, containing a sophisticated system of differential gears built centuries before such technology became commonplace, and as the journal Nature reported, the Antikythera mechanism will transform the way we think about the technological capabilities of the ancient world. A 7.5-ton X-ray tomography scanner, akin to the kind used on patients, was used to study the device, and it revealed a complicated arrangement of 30 precision, hand-cut bronze gears, housed inside a wooden case covered in inscriptions. From their studies, they have inferred that there were at least 7 more gears, along with iron or steel axles. Overall, the mechanism is technically more complex than any comparable known mechanical device for at least a millennium afterwards. The hand-driven mechanism would have been a wonder of its age, the supercomputer of its day, which could do multiplication, division, addition and subtraction. One of the provocative issues raised by this machine, said Professor Edmonds, is what other mechanical devices the ancient Greeks managed to construct. It does raise the question, what else were they making at the time, he said. Another profound question is how this extraordinary technology was lost when the Roman Empire came to dominate the Mediterranean. In terms of historic and scarcity value, I have to regard this mechanism as being more valuable than the Mona Lisa, he added. François Charette of Ludwig Maximilian's University said that scholars are stunned at the ingenuity of the ancients, but there will be plenty more speculation about how this marvel was used. The Antikythera mechanism also reveals that the history of technology is far from linear, since this level of instrument making not surpassed until the Renaissance. Professor Edmonds said, it makes you wonder what they would have achieved if they'd have carried on, and the Romans hadn't taken over and put a stop to things. Would they have had a man on the moon by AD 300? It sounds ridiculous, but if they were able to construct something as technically brilliant as this, it's not complete fantasy.
The second evidence of an advanced technology is ancient airplanes. Some researchers and a few rogue scientists believe there's evidence to suggest that humans achieved flight earlier in history, much earlier. So early, they say, that the knowledge of this technology has been lost and ancient stories that recount adventures of human flight have been relegated only to myth. In 1898, a peculiar 6-inch wooden object was found in a tomb at Saqqara, Egypt that dated back to about 200 BC. The object had a body or fuselage, 7-inch wings that curved downward slightly, a fixed rudder and a tail. It looked very much like a modern airplane or glider. But since airplanes had not yet been invented in 1898, never mind ancient Egypt, it was labeled as a model of a bird and stored away in the basement of the Cairo Museum. The object was rediscovered many years later by Dr. Khalil Messiha, an authority on ancient models. According to Messiha and others who have studied the object, it has characteristics of very advanced aerodynamics, much like modern pusher gliders that require very little power to stay aloft. The curved wings are today known as reversidihedral wings, which can attain great amounts of lift. A similar design is employed on the supersonic Concorde aircraft. Was it a scale model of an aircraft the Egyptians planned to build, or did build? Even more controversial than the model airplane are the enigmatic carvings found in the Temple of Abydos, Egypt by Dr. Ruth Hover. Hover photographed a wall panel which had been revealed when a newer overlaying panel crumbled and fell off. The older panel beneath contained embossed images that resemble modern aircraft. One bears a striking resemblance to a modern helicopter, while others could be interpreted as aircraft or hovercraft. But Egypt isn't the only ancient civilization that has produced puzzling artifacts. A remarkable gold trinket estimated to be at least 1,000 years old, dating perhaps to between 500 and 800 AD, was found in Central America and along coastal areas of South America. If you weren't aware of its age, you might guess that it was a child's model of the space shuttle or a Delta Wing fighter aircraft. It looks distinctly mechanical with its delta-shaped wings, stabilizer fins and rudder. It even has what looks like a pilot's seat in the right place. Whatever this object is supposed to be or represent, its remarkable resemblance to a modern aircraft or spacecraft is uncanny. And besides, there may very well have been a reason to fly. Spread over a 37 by 15 mile plateau near Nazca, Peru are huge works of art drawn on the ground by people of the Paracas and Nazca cultures. The figures, called geoglyphs, are stylized portraits of 18 different kinds of birds, a curly-tailed monkey as big as a football field, a killer whale, a 150-foot spider, a lizard, human forms and other strange objects. No one knows for certain when the geoglyphs were made, or why. But since they were discovered, archaeologists have wondered why these people would create such monumental works of art that could not be appreciated from the ground. The figures can only be distinguished when viewed from a great height. In fact, they were discovered in recent times only when an explorer noticed them when flying over them in an airplane. Since there are no nearby mountains or other elevated areas nearby from which to look down on the Nazca lines, how were they ever seen? Because of Nazca's large grids of crisscrossing paths, some extending as long as 6 miles that seem to go nowhere, some researchers have suggested that the paths are runways for aircraft, and that their pilots and passengers were those privileged who were able to view the large-scale figures. The third evidence of an advanced technology is ancient spheres. Over the last few decades, miners in South Africa have been digging up mysterious metal spheres. In fact, a few hundred of them. Their origin is unknown and they measure approximately an inch or so in diameter, and some are finely etched with three parallel grooves running around the equator. Two types of spheres have been found, one is composed of a solid bluish metal with flecks of white, the other is hollowed out and filled with a spongy white substance. Specialists have concluded that they could not have occurred by any natural process. The problem they present is that rock in which they were found is Precambrian, supposedly dated 2.8 billion years old. Who made them and for what purpose is unknown. The fourth evidence of an advanced technology is ancient batteries. Today batteries can be found in any grocery, drug, convenience and department store you come across. But apparently they've been around for thousands of years. Several batteries known as the Baghdad batteries were found in the ruins of a Parthian village and its existence could require history books throughout the world to be rewritten. The device consists of a 5.5-inch high clay vessel inside of which was a copper cylinder held in place by asphalt, and inside of that was an oxidized iron rod. Experts who examined it concluded that the device needed only to be filled with an acid or alkaline liquid to produce an electric charge. F.M. Gray of the General Electric High Voltage Laboratory in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, built some reproductions. When filled with an electrolyte like grape juice, the devices produced about 2 volts. It is believed that this ancient battery might have been used for electroplating objects with gold. German researcher Drive. Arne Egebricht used copies of the batteries to electroplate items and suggests that many ancient items in museums that are thought to be gold may actually be gold-plated silver. If so, how was this technology lost, and the battery not rediscovered for another 1,800 years? The fifth evidence of an advanced technology is ancient spark plugs. While mineral hunting in the mountains of California near Olancha during the winter of 1961, Wallace Lane, Virginia Maxey and Mike Mickasel found a rock, among many others, that they thought was a geode that would make a good addition for their gem shop. However, upon cutting it open, they found an object inside that seemed to be made of white porcelain. In the center was a shaft of shiny metal. Further investigation revealed that the porcelain was surrounded by a hexagonal casing, and an X-ray revealed a tiny spring at one end, like a spark plug. Experts estimated that, if this was a geode, it should have taken about 500,000 years for this fossil-encrusted nodule to form, yet the object inside was obviously of sophisticated human manufacture. How could a spark plug get inside a 500,000-year-old rock? The sixth evidence of an advanced technology is ancient stone balls. Workmen hacking and burning their way through the dense jungle of Costa Rica to clear an area for banana plantations in the 1930s stumbled upon some incredible objects, dozens of stone balls, many of which were perfectly spherical. Almost all of them are made of granodiorite, a hard, igneous stone. These objects are not natural in origin, rather, they are monolithic sculptures made by human hands. They varied in size from as small as a tennis ball to an astonishing 8 feet in diameter and weighing 16 tons. Although the great stone balls are clearly man-made, it is unknown who made them, for what purpose and, most puzzling, how they achieved such spherical precision. The balls have been endangered since the moment of their discovery. Many have been destroyed, dynamited by treasure hunters or cracked and broken by agricultural activities. Today, only a handful are known to be in their original locations. The seventh evidence of an advanced technology is ancient stone columns. Ancient monolithic stone columns of an unbelievable size and weight have been discovered. One such column was cut as one solid piece and weighs 1,200 tons. Its two cousins are in place in the base of the Temple of Jupiter and weigh in at over 1,000 tons. The temple is one of the largest stone structures in the world. Some 26 feet above the structure's base are found three of the largest stones ever employed by man. Each of these stones measures 10 feet thick, 13 feet high, and is over 60 feet long. Knowing the density of limestone permits weight estimates of over 1.2 million pounds. Some people with impressive engineering skills cut, dressed, and moved these immense stone blocks from a quarry 3/4 of a mile away. A walk to this quarry introduces the observer to the monolith, an even larger block of limestone, 13 feet 5 inches, 15 feet 6 inches, and 69 feet 11 inches. The monolith weighs in at over 2 million pounds. In comparison, the largest stones used in the Great Pyramid tip the scales at only 400,000 pounds. As one person stated, "Forget the ancient airplanes, the ancient helicopters, the world maps, this alone should set the standard straight line, primitive man to advanced man, and then to civilization, scientific dogma on its ear. There is no way that this stone can be explained by the science and history they teach us in school. There are no historical records, although the local folks think it is a pre-flood city originally built by Cain, after his banishment." The eighth evidence of an advanced technology is ancient maps. A Russian scientist recently found a 3D aerial relief map that, according to evolution, is dated at 120 million year old. It seems to be impossible, but the scientists of Bashkir State University have found indisputable proofs of an ancient highly developed civilization's existence. This is a real relief map, and today's military has similar kinds of maps. The map contains civil engineering works, a system of channels with a length of about 12,000 kilometers, weirs, powerful dams. Not far from the channels, diamond-shaped grounds are shown, whose destination is unknown. The map also contains numerous inscriptions. At first, the scientists thought that it was old Chinese language. Though, it turned out that the subscriptions were done in a hieroglyphic syllabic language of unknown origin. The scientists never managed to read it. A professor of Bashkir State University admits, "The more I learn, the more I understand that I know nothing. The geological structure of the slab was determined. It consists of three levels. The base is 14 centimeters thick, made of the firmest dolomite. The second level is probably the most interesting, made of diopside glass. The longer the slab was studied, the more mysteries appeared." On the map, a giant irrigative system could be seen. In addition to the rivers, there are two 500-meter-wide channel systems, 12 dams, 300 to 500 meters wide, approximately 10 kilometers long and 3 kilometers deep each. The dams most likely helped in turning water in either side, while to create them over 1 quadrillion cubic meters of earth was shifted. In comparison with that irrigative system, modern systems look like a mere scratch on the relief. Alexander Chubby-Wyrov supposes that now mankind can build only a small part of what is pictured on the map. The ninth evidence of an advanced technology is ancient metal nodules. In 1968, French speleologist Y. Drouet and H. Salfati reported finding unusual metal nodules entombed in an Aptian chalk bed in a quarry at Saint-Jean-de-Livet. The nodules are reddish-brown, wafer-shaped and hollowed at the ends, measuring from 3 to 9 centimeters long and 1 to 4 centimeters wide. The two investigators at first thought the nodules were fossils until they discovered their metallic nature. Next, they theorize they were residue from a meteor, but careful studies show the nodules were too uniformly shaped to be of natural origin. Chemical analysis showed a carbon content consistent with modern forging and casting techniques. But what had these man-made objects been doing in chalk beds dating toward the end of the Cretaceous, over 120 million years? As Drouet and Salfati concluded, these objects, then, prove the presence of intelligent life on Earth long before the limits given today by prehistoric archaeology. The 10th evidence of an advanced technology is ancient iron bands. On June 13, 1880, a reporter for the Inverness Courier named Walter Carruthers was vacationing near Loch Moray and Victoria Falls, in Scotland, and, being an amateur rock hunter, decided to explore the geology of the area. Between 300 and 400 yards above Victoria Falls, and immediately beside the last of the three lesser falls on the west side of the stream, Carruthers noticed peculiar impressions in the rock. The rock was a 6 by 16 foot exposed surface of torrid and red sandstone, placed in the Cambrian Age. The impressions consisted of two continuous flat bands side by side, between 1¼ and 1½ inches wide and about 1/4 inch deep, running unnaturally straight through the flat layers of sandstone in place, and perfectly distinct for 16 feet, disappearing on the west side under the superimposed rock, and broken only where portions of the sandstone had been weathered out. A few weeks later, the curious bands were also observed by a colleague of Carruthers, Mr. William Jolly, Her Majesty's Inspector of Schools for the region. Carruthers had thought the impressions to have been the creation of some highly unusual living creature, but Jolly recorded that the continuous even breadth and square section of the bands would seem to render this impossible. Jolly further noted, "The double band resembles nothing more nearly than the hollow impression that would be left by double bars of iron placed closely together." Jolly's observation was corroborated years later when micro specks of iron oxide were taken from the impression cavities. The superintendent thought, however, that perhaps the iron bands had at one time been inserted into the rock, to clasp some structure to it, but other findings discount this. First, the bands occur high above the falls in an almost totally inaccessible place, where a structure would serve little purpose. Second, the bands are only 1/4 inch deep, so that anything clasped to them would not hold for long. Third, parallel on either side of each band are ripple marks in the sandstone, indicating the presence of the original iron bands had caused turbulence patterns in the sand during the time the sand had been laid down by water, and before it had turned to stone. Fourth, the sandstone in the impression show tiny striations which are really the preserved grain marks of the iron, again, indicating the metal had been impressed in the primordial sand, before solidification took place. And finally, fifth, one portion of one of the bands bends back into the subsurface, and careful excavation revealed the presence of iron oxide totally encased by the surrounding sandstone. Jolly also found other band impressions in the same locality. There is a third band that runs alongside the other two, but is much less distinct and is not continuous. Two more lines, about 2 feet lower down on the rock surface, are only 7 feet long, and two more are higher up, running 3 feet long. Jolly also saw still more bands on an outcropping of the same sandstone on the other side of the stream, again parallel to one another, one 3 feet, another 6 feet, and smaller portions of several others. What purpose these iron bands served, we can only guess. What we do know, however, is that all the bands were very uniform in width and thickness, with squared edges, and the grain marks they left indicate they were rolled and cut, all of which points to precision manufacturing by machine production. But this is totally impossible, if we are to believe the geologists, for the sandstone in which the bands occur is Cambrian, which evolution dates to be supposedly 600 million years old. Who, pray tell, was running an iron mill at a time when there were supposedly only tiny invertebrate creatures ruling the world? The 11th evidence of an advanced technology is ancient tile floors. On June 27, 1969, workmen in Oklahoma cutting into a rock shelf came upon a find that was to create much controversy among the experts. The find was an inlaid tile floor, found 3 feet below the surface, and covering several thousand square feet. Durwood Pate, an Oklahoma City geologist, commented on the floor in the Edmund Booster of July 3, 1969.
"I am sure this was man-made because the stones are placed in perfect sets of parallel lines which intersect to form a diamond shape, all pointing to the east. We found post holes which measure a perfect 2 rods from the other two. The top of the stone is very smooth, and if you lift one of them, you will find it is very jagged, which indicates wear on the surface. Everything is too well placed to be a natural formation."
Pate also discovered a form of mortar between the tiles. He believes now that the tile surface served as a common floor for several human shelters over a wide area. Delbert Smith, a geologist and president of the Oklahoma Seismograph Company, summed up the mystery concerning the tile floor in the Tulsa World of June 29, 1969, there is no question about it. It had been laid there, but I have no idea by whom. Yet another facet of the mystery involved the question of age. There are some differing opinions as to the geology involved, but the best estimate places the tiles at an evolutionary age of a supposed 200,000 years old. Even more amazing is the discovery in 1936 by Tom Kenny, a resident of Plateau Valley, a town located on the western slope of the Rockies in Colorado. He was excavating for a winter cellar to store vegetables, when at a depth of 10 feet his spade hit a barrier. Clearing the covering material away, he unearthed a pavement made of tiles, each man-made and 5 inches square. The tiles were laid in mortar, the chemical composition of which later analysis showed was different from all materials found in the valley. The perplexing problem is that the strange pavement was found in the same layer containing the three-toed Miocene horse, which evolution dates upwards of 30 million years old. The 12th evidence of an advanced technology is ancient walls. In the early spring of 1891, a farmer named J.H. Hooper was examining a wooded ridge on his property, located in Bradley County, 13 miles from Cleveland, Tennessee. A peculiar stone caught his attention, which he first took to be a grave marker. But digging around it, he soon discovered that the stone was only a surface projection of a subterranean structure that extended into the depths below. Hooper spent the next several weeks in an attempt to uncover his unusual find, a length of wall, traced for 1,000 feet, on the average 2 feet thick and 8 feet high, with numerous projections, like the first one, spaced along the top every 25 to 30 feet. The wall ran roughly at an angle of 15 to 20 degrees east. The structure continues on beyond the section exposed, in both directions, following the crest of a ridge that extends from the Hiawassee River north of Chattanooga southward, where it dips beneath the Tennessee River. The wall is composed of red sandstone blocks constructed in three courses, cemented together with a dark red clay mixed with salt, and in numerous places is plastered over with red, slate and yellow clays. Along one stretch of wall, near the northern end a distance of 16 feet, Hooper made without a doubt the most important discovery. Hidden beneath the outer clay plasterings, a number of the sandstone block surfaces were covered with the hieroglyphs of a lost language. The letters were arranged in wavy, parallel and diagonal lines, interspersed with small pictures of strange animals, many unidentifiable. There were other symbols too, of the sun and crescent moon, which appear to have some astronomical significance. Altogether, 872 individual characters were made out, many repeated, suggesting the script is a form of pictographic writing, like Chinese. Despite the implications of the wall, and the challenge of the discovery of an unknown writing, the find was met by the scientific community with overwhelming apathy. A short notice on the Tennessee Mystery Wall appeared in the Transactions of the New York Academy of Sciences written by A.L. Rawson, who examined the structure and script firsthand, as well as published copies he had made of some of the glyphs and pictures. But that was all, no further study was ever made. One probably doesn't have to wonder why, because the position of the wall places it geologically to near the beginning of the Quaternary period, which means, according to evolution, it's supposedly over a million years old. The 13th evidence of an advanced technology is ancient letters. In November 1829, a block of marble measuring over 30 cubic feet was excavated from a depth of between 60 to 70 feet, from the Henderson Quarry, located 12 miles northwest of Philadelphia. The block was sent to the Savage Marble Sawmill in nearby Norristown for cutting into slabs for construction. After taking off one slab about 3 feet wide and 6 feet long, workmen noticed something strange. They had exposed an unnaturally straight-edged, rectangular indentation. Several respectable townsmen were called to the scene, and in their presence the rest of the block surface was carefully removed. Revealed were two sharply defined engraved letters, resembling an I, and a U with a squared base. The indentations were 1.5 inches long and 5/8 of an inch in width. There was no way the letters could have been of recent origin, they were deeply embedded in the marble. More mysterious, the marble had come from a very old lime rock. Evolution gives it a supposed estimated age of about 65 million years. The 14th evidence of an advanced technology is ancient springs. Thousands of spiral, screw-like objects sized as small as 1/10th of an inch have been found beginning in the early 90s. And are still being found by gold miners in the Ural Mountains in Russia. These metal items found in depths from 3 to 40 feet are thought, according to evolution, to be 20,000 years or more old. As one person commented,
"Contrary to what some commentators believe, however, we don't think that these objects are extraterrestrial in origin. Rather, we think their origin is very terrestrial, the vestiges of a former high-tech civilization, the evidence of which will become increasingly apparent over the coming years."
as one person stated in light of all this overwhelming evidence.
It is one thing to find evidence of human skeletal remains and footprints in the incredible past, but it is something else again to discover artifacts that prove the existence of advanced cultures in the strata as well. One of the characteristics of any high civilization is its ability to work metals. Conservative historians and archaeologists, who hold to the concept of linear cultural development, point to the ancient Middle East as the home of the very first metal production. Here, they claim, man began to melt and shape copper, iron, gold, and silver only 8,000 years ago. But unusual relics brought up from the depths of the rocky earth tell a different story.
Now, folks, I don't know about you, but it sure looks to me like there really was a highly advanced civilization prior to the flood. How about you? So much for dragging your knuckles on the ground. Hello. Apes didn't do that, folks. Are you kidding me? These are highly advanced, super smart people, exactly like the Bible says they were. Oh, but that's not all. The second evidence of a glorious pre-flood civilization is from ancient artifacts.
2 Peter 3:3-6. First of all, you must understand that in the last days scoffers will come, scoffing and following their own evil desires. They will say, "Where is this coming he promised? Ever since our fathers died, everything goes on as it has since the beginning of creation." But they deliberately forget that long ago by God's word the heavens existed and the earth was formed out of water and by water. By these waters also the world of that time was deluged and destroyed.
Now folks, according to our text, the Bible clearly says that scoffers would not only come in the last days, and these scoffers would not only mock the return of Jesus Christ in the last days, but what did the text say was the basis for their arrogant mocking? They were willingly ignorant of the fact that there used to be a world in the past that has long since now been destroyed by the flood, right? And so stop and think about it. In order for them to be willingly ignorant, which means they purposely choose to deny the evidence of a pre-flood world, then there must be proof or even artifacts of this pre-flood world for all eyes to see, right? Exactly. And so that's the question. Do we see any clear-cut artifacts of a pre-flood world that clearly show us there really was a world that used to exist but has now long since been destroyed? Of course. In fact, just like you'd expect to find if there really was a worldwide flood, these artifacts are discovered encased in coal deposits that were also formed at the time of the flood. And that makes total sense because if coal really was formed at the time of the flood by the swirling remains of pre-flood plants, then we should expect to find at least a few of the pre-flood artifacts mixed in there as well. Well, hey, guess what? That's exactly what we find. Let's take a look. The first evidence of an ancient artifact is metal cubes. According to evolution, humans were not even around 65 million years ago, let alone people who could work metal. So how then does science explain semi-ovoid metallic tubes dug out of supposed 65 million year old Cretaceous chalk in France? And how does it also explain how in 1885, a block of coal was broken open to find a metal cube obviously worked by intelligent hands? What are we to make of these finds? Obviously, intelligent humans date back much, much further than we realize. These examples, and there are many more, should prompt any curious and open-minded scientist to re-examine and rethink the true history of life on Earth. The second evidence of an ancient artifact is iron pots. In 1912, some coal mine near Wilburton, Oklahoma, revealed a mystery, which has still not been solved. According to evolution, this chunk of coal was formed some 300 to 325 million years ago. Yet, when two employees of a municipal electric plant came upon a solid chunk of coal, they found it too large for the furnace. So they broke it up with a sledge and an iron pot fell out from the center where it had left an impression in the piece of coal. An affidavit was made out by the two witnesses and the pot was photographed. Many persons examined this strange object. After the exhibitor died, the pot was disposed of in some way and is now lost. The third evidence of an ancient artifact is hammers. In June of 1934, Max Hahn discovered a rock, sitting loose on a rock ledge beside a waterfall outside London, Texas. This site is part of a large geographical zone called the Edwards Plateau and it primarily consists of Cretaceous rock, supposedly dated at 75 to 100 million years old. Noticing that this weathered rock had wood protruding from it, he and family members cracked it open with a hammer and chisel, exposing the hammerhead to the light of day for the first time since the stone formed around it. To verify that the hammer was made of metal, they cut into one of the beveled sides with a file. In the resulting nick, bright, shiny iron was exposed. The bright metal in the nick is still there, with no detectable corrosion. The metal hammerhead is approximately 6 inches long with a diameter of 1 inch. This seems somewhat small for a gross pounding instrument, suggesting that this tool was meant for fine work or soft metal. The end of the handle visible through the top of the hammerhead eye appears sawn off. The handle is fossilized with a blackened cold tip and the head is made out of a rare iron mixture with chlorine. The density of the iron in a central, cross-sectional plane shows the interior metal to be very pure, with no bubbles. Modern industry cannot consistently produce iron castings with this quality. Could this be a pre-flood tool? The composition, chlorine fabricated with metallic iron, remains a puzzling enigma. The fourth evidence of an ancient artifact is statues. In 1921, an Arkansan named Rollins was digging in one of the many gravel pits on a line of small hillocks known as Crowley's Ridge, located 2 miles north of Finch. At a depth of 10 feet, Rollins' shovel suddenly struck something large and solid. The object appeared at first to be a boulder, but excavating around it, Rollins soon discovered that it was a large rock-sculptured head of a man. It stood about 4 feet high, and the figure had a squared, protruding chin, small, tight-lipped mouth, a short nose, and a furrowed brow and stare accented by 2 flat buttons of inlaid gold for eyes. 2 more gold discs ornamented the figure's ears, and a heart-shaped plug of copper was embedded in the chest. The top of the head was covered by a carved hood that draped down the nape, and attached to a piece around the neck. Near the head, and in the same layer, Rollins dug up a number of smaller objects, a gold ring, a small coffer made of volcanic pumice, which does not exist in this region, and tiny carvings of men, animals, moons and stars. The head and artifacts soon became a local attraction, and the newspapers dubbed the glowering figure King Crowley. Several investigators authenticated the find, though they could not explain its presence in the 10-foot layer of gravel, geologically dated by evolution at a supposed 175,000 years. The head and objects were sent to the Arkansas Natural History Museum in Little Rock. The museum curators, who also examined the artifacts and had double-checked and documented their discovery, were confident in the findings' authenticity to place them on public display. At the same time, however, some of the small carving samples were mailed to the Smithsonian in Washington. The Smithsonian, being a far more conservative institution, or should we say close-minded, described the carvings as truly unexplained items, but could not reconcile the antiquity of the strata in which they had been brought to light. Finally, after 15 years of vacillating on the subject, orthodoxy triumphed. The Smithsonian concluded that the Crowley Ridge artifacts could not be 175,000 years old as this contradicted established theory on the age of human civilization, and therefore declared the artifacts fakes. Conforming to this prestigious conservative pronouncement, the Little Rock Museum promptly took the stone head and other objects off display, and eventually sold them to unnamed private collectors. The King Crowley head was shipped off to California, and the rest of the collection was similarly scattered to the four winds. Today, the location of even a single object is unknown. The fifth evidence of an ancient artifact is vases. In the June 1851 issue of Scientific American, Volume 7, pages 298-299, a report from the Boston Transcript was published about how 2 parts of a metal vase were dynamited out of solid rock, 15 feet below the surface, on Meeting House Hill in Dorchester, Massachusetts. According to evolution, the rock the vase was encased in was estimated to be supposedly 100,000 years old. But when the 2 parts were put together, they formed a bell-shaped vase that was 4.5 inches high, 6.5 inches at the base, 2.5 inches at the top, and 1/8 inch thick. The metal was composed of an alloy of zinc and a considerable portion of silver. On the sides were 6 flower bouquets inlaid with pure silver, and around the lower part was a vine or wreath also inlaid with silver. The chasing, carving, and inlaying are exquisitely done by some unknown craftsman. The sixth evidence of an ancient artifact is nails and screws. The Illinois Springfield Republican reported in 1851 that a businessman named Hiram DeWitt brought back with him from a trip to California a piece of auriferous quartz rock about the size of a man's fist, and while showing the rock to a friend, it slipped from his hand and split open upon hitting the floor. There, in the center of the quartz, they discovered a cut iron nail, 6-penny size, slightly corroded but entirely straight, with a perfect head. The problem is that, according to evolution, the quartz is given an age of over 1 million years. A letter kept in the archives of Madrid and dated 1572, records the account of the Spanish viceroy in Peru and a strange artifact, which came into his possession. In the year the letter was written, Indian miners removed from a subsurface layer of gravel a large conglomerate boulder, and broke it into pieces for easier disposal. As the mass shattered to the hammer blow, out of the center of it fell a perfect 6-inch nail. The nail was later given to the viceroy as a souvenir, who had it thoroughly examined and verified its finding. The first mystery is that iron was unknown to the Peruvian Indians, so the nail did not originate with them. And the second mystery is that the rock from which the nail was freed was in the neighborhood of 75,000 to 100,000 years in age. In 1865, a 2-inch metal screw was discovered and a piece of feldspar unearthed from the Abbey Mine in Treasure City, Nevada. The screw had long ago oxidized, but its form, particularly the shape of its threads, could clearly be seen in the feldspar. The problem is that, according to evolution, the stone it was found in is supposedly 21 million years old. In 1844, Sir David Brewster submitted a report to the British Association for the Advancement of Science that created quite a stir. A nail obviously made by humans had been found half embedded in a sandstone block excavated from the Kyne Goody Quarry near Inchira, in northern Britain. It was badly corroded, but nonetheless identifiable. The problem is that, according to evolution, the sandstone was determined to be at least 40 million years old. The seventh evidence of an ancient artifact is bells. In 1944, as a 10-year-old boy, Newton Anderson dropped a lump of coal in his basement and found that it contained this bell inside. The bituminous coal that was mined near his house in Upshur County, West Virginia, is supposed to be about 300 million years old. What is a brass bell with an iron clapper doing in coal ascribed to the Carboniferous period? The bell was extensively analyzed at the University of Oklahoma and it was found to contain an unusual mixture of metals, different from any known modern alloy production, including copper, zinc, tin, arsenic, iodine, and selenium. One researcher believes that the bell is obviously an antediluvian artifact, that is, an artifact made before the Genesis flood. The eighth evidence of an ancient artifact is jewelry. On June 9, 1891, Mrs. S. W. Culp of Morrisonville, Illinois, was shoveling coal into her kitchen stove when a large lump broke in two and a gold chain fell out from the center. The chain, about 10 inches long, made of 8-carat gold and weighing 8 pennyweight, was described as being of antique workmanship. The June 11th issue of the Morrisonville Times reported that investigators were convinced the chain had not simply been accidentally dropped in with the coal. One portion of the coal lump still clung to the chain, while the part that had separated from it still bore the impression of where the chain had been encased. The Times could only comment, "Here is one for the student of archaeology who loves to puzzle his brain over the geological construction of the earth from whose ancient depth the curious are always dropping out." In this case, the curious item dropped out of a piece of coal from the Pennsylvanian era that according to evolution is supposedly dated over 300 million years old. Oh, but that's not all. Workmen quarrying stone near the River Tweed below Rutherford, Scotland in 1844, found a piece of gold thread embedded in the rock of the quarry 8 feet below ground level. A small piece of the thread was sent to the offices of the local newspaper, the Kelso Chronicle, for the inspection of the curious. Then in 1851, in Illinois, a well drilling bit brought up from a sand stratum 120 feet deep two copper artifacts of what appears to be a hook and a ring. Their age, according to evolution, is supposedly around 150,000 years old. The ninth evidence of an ancient artifact is axes. In 1826, a well dug near the Ohio River in North Cincinnati failed to produce water, but did produce the unexpected. From a level 94 feet down, a buried tree stump was brought to the surface, which showed the marks of an axe. The marks were deep and well cut, indicating the use of a sharp and durable blade. The suspicion that the axe had been made of metal was confirmed when, embedded in the top of the stump, an advanced oxidized wedge of iron was found. The layer from which the stump came was estimated to be between 50,000 and 75,000 years old, nearly 10 times the accepted age of the supposed first metal usage. The tenth evidence of an ancient artifact is coins. At Lawn Ridge, 20 miles north of Peoria, Illinois, August of 1870, three men were drilling an artesian well, when, from a depth of over 100 feet, the pump brought up a small metal medallion to the surface. The strange coin medallion was composed of an unidentified copper alloy, about the size and thickness of a U.S. quarter of that period. It was remarkably uniform in thickness, round, and the edges appeared to have been cut. Researcher William E. Dubois, who presented his investigation of the medallion to the American Philosophical Society, was convinced that the object had in fact passed through a rolling mill. The edges showed further evidence of the machine shop. Both sides of the medallion were marked with artwork and hieroglyphs, but these had not been metal engraved or stamped. Rather, the figures had somehow been etched in acid, to a remarkable degree of intricacy. One side showed the figure of a woman wearing a crown or headdress, her left arm is raised as if in benediction, and her right arm holds a small child, also crowned. The woman appears to be speaking. On the opposite side is another central figure, that looks like a crouching animal. It has long, pointed ears, large eyes and mouth, claw-like arms, and a long tail frayed at the very end. Below and to the left of it is another animal, which bears a strong resemblance to a horse. Around the outer edges of both sides of the coin are undecipherable glyphs. They are of very definite character, and show all the signs of a form of alphabetic writing. In 1876, the medallion was presented by Professor Winchell to a meeting of the Geological Section of the American Association in Buffalo. One participant, a conservative historian, Professor J.R. Leslie, tried to explain the object as a practical joke dropped into a hole by a passing French or Spanish explorer. However, Winchell countered against such an interpretation. 1. By no stretch of the imagination were the figures and glyphs decipherable in terms of any known symbology or script. 2. Who, as a practical joke, would have dropped a metal object into a hole and known that someone several hundred years later would happen to drill at that precise spot, within a 4-inch tolerance and find it? The odds would be phenomenal. And 3. There is the very real problem of explaining the accumulation of 114 feet of deposit over the buried coin. Having examined all the evidence, Winchell was convinced the coin had indeed come from this depth. It had not fallen into a hole in the past, the sediments drilled through were uniform and undisturbed. And the amount of sedimentation was not what would have settled in only a few centuries. In fact, according to evolution, this depth is supposedly between 100,000 and 150,000 years. What conclusions can we draw about the mystery coin? A lost civilization once existed which worked in copper and other metals, possessed art and writing, attired themselves with crowns and other clothing, knew of and perhaps domesticated several animals including the horse, utilized acids for etching in a manner that is still not understood today, and perhaps the most disturbing, possessed forms of machinery for the cutting, rolling and processing of metal pieces. The 11th evidence of an ancient artifact is iron cubes. In the fall of 1885, at an iron foundry owned by the sons of Herr Isidor Braun located in Schondorf near Bocklebrook, Upper Austria, a workman named Riedel was breaking up a block of tertiary brown coal that had been mined from the pits at Wolfsegg, near Schwanstadt, and was about to be used to heat the foundry's giant smelters. As the block disintegrated into several pieces, out dropped a strange cube-like object. In 1886, mining engineer Dr. Adolf Gerlt made a report to the Natural History Society at Bonn, Germany and noted that the object, coated with a thin layer of rust, is made of iron, measures 2.64 by 2.64 by 1.85 inches, weighs 1.73 pounds and has a specific gravity measurement of 7.75. Four of the iron cube sides are roughly flat, while the two remaining sides, opposite each other, are convex. A fairly deep groove was incised all the way around the object, about midway up its height. Other early studies on the iron artifact were in scientific journals of the day such as Nature London, November 11, 1886, page 36, and L'Astronomie, Paris, 1886, page 463. A plaster cast was also made before the turn of the century, important because the original object subsequently suffered from handling, and from being disfigured by samples having been cut from it by investigators for research. The cast is kept in the Oberösterreichisches Landesmuseum in Linz, Austria, where the original object was also exhibited from 1950 to 1958. The iron cube is presently in the custody of Herrn O.R. Bernhard of the Heimathaus Museum in Vaucluburg. In 1966-67, the iron cube was carefully analyzed by experts at the Vienna Naturhistorisches Museum, using electron beam microanalysis. They found no traces of nickel, chromium or cobalt in the iron, which means the object was not of meteoric origin. No sulfur was detected either, ruling out the chance of it being a pyrite, a natural mineral that sometimes forms geometric shapes. Because of a low magnesium content, Dr. Kurt of the museum, and Dr. Argill of the Geologisches Bundesanstalt of Vienna, are of the opinion that the object was made of cast iron. In 1973, Hubert Matlener concluded from yet another detailed investigation that the object had been made from a hand-sculptured lump of wax or clay pressed into a sand base, this forming the mold into which the iron had been poured. The final conclusion, then, is that the strange object is definitely man-made. What is not explained is what it was doing encased in coal, dating according to evolution to be supposedly 60 million years old. The 12th evidence of an ancient artifact is alphabets. The Los Angeles News of December 17, 1869 printed an account supplied to the paper by a correspondent of the Cleveland Herald, writing from Wellsville, Ohio. The account described how in the autumn of the year, at a coal mine operated by a Captain Lacey of Hammondville, a miner named James Parsons was loosening a large mass at a depth of 100 feet, when he suddenly exposed a smooth slate wall covered with strange alphabetic writing. The letters were raised and well-defined. The coal that had covered the wall bore their distinct impression, which means the letters date to a time when the coal was in a vegetable state, and had molded itself against the wall. Each sign was 3/4 of an inch in size, and arranged in rows precisely spaced 3 inches apart. The first line of letters contained 25. Local teachers and ministers examined the find, but could offer no explanations. Isn't that sad? But the most disturbing fact about the mysterious slate wall and its glyphs was their undeniable presence in coal, coal from the Carboniferous era, that evolution dates well over a supposed 200 million years old. The 13th evidence of an ancient artifact is dolls. On August 1, 1889, a professional well driller, M.A. Kurtz, was working near his home in Nampa, Idaho, along with two other crewmen, when their steam pump suddenly spat out a piece of brownish clay 1.5 inches long that was clearly humanoid in appearance. The discovery was also eyewitnessed by several prominent citizens of Nampa. What amazed these men was that the little clay doll had come from below a 15-foot layer of lava rock, 100 feet of sand, 6 inches of clay, 40 feet of more sand, then 165 feet composed of clay, sand, clay nodules mixed with sand, and coarse sand layers, a total of 320 feet. The small doll is composed of half clay and half quartz, and according to at least one expert, Professor Albert A. Wright of Oberlin College, it was not the product of a small child or amateur, but was made by a true artist. Though badly battered by time, the doll's appearance is still distinct. It has a bulbous head, with barely discernible mouth and eyes, broad shoulders, short, thick arms, and long legs, the right leg broken off. There are also faint geometric markings on the figure, which represent either clothing patterns or jewelry. They are found mostly on the chest around the neck, and on the arms and wrist. The doll is the image of a person of a high civilization, artistically attired. Furthermore, the pump worked in only one direction. Had the object fallen into the hole from above, it would have been destroyed by the pump. Wright concluded in a report to the Boston Society that, there is no ground to question the fact that this image came up in the sand pump from the depth reported. The problem is, the layer of rock the doll was found in is given an estimated evolutionary age of over 300,000 years. Today, the Nampa doll is on exhibit at the Idaho State Historical Society in Boise. Curiously enough, a second doll-like figure was discovered sometime before 1880 near Marlboro in Stark County, Ohio, by workmen drilling a well. The image, made of black variegated marble and standing 6 inches tall, was unearthed from a depth of only 120 feet. But was embedded in sand and gravel of a similar type and age as that of the Nampa doll. There were two things remarkable about the Ohio figure. First, the marble it is made of is not indigenous to Ohio, and second, it bears an astonishing resemblance to the image found at Nampa. One can see in it the same bulbous head, simple facial features, stocky frame and long arms and legs. Did the two, the Ohio and Idaho dolls, come from the same enigmatic lost civilization? The evidence answers yes. The 14th evidence of an ancient artifact is utensils.
A large ladle, or large cup-like spoon, was discovered by Myrna Burdick of Pennsylvania after she burned a huge lump of coal back in 1937. After cleaning away the residue of brown ashes from her stove, Mrs. Burdick noticed the ceramic ladle, which at the time was still intact. The handle was later broken off, possibly for the purpose of testing by personnel at the prestigious Smithsonian Institution. The Smithsonian researchers who examined the artifact were highly skeptical of the claim that it was originally embedded in the coal. No report was ever released regarding their findings, if any. The story was first published, in a very brief article, by Harry Wyant in 1976, who assumed the spoon might represent an antediluvian relic, that is, a remnant of the pre-flood civilization. But this is not an isolated case. A rather extensive assortment of similar man-made objects have been recovered from coal seams. They include an iron thimble, a borer or drill bit, an iron instrument, 3 throwing spears, and even a carved stone plate bearing the image of a man's face. By evolutionary dating techniques, these objects would be hundreds of millions of years older than man. Again, something is wrong. The question confronting all of those who have happened upon these remarkable finds has yet to be adequately addressed by evolutionist archaeologists and geologists. How did these modern artifacts arrive in deposits alleged to have originated multiple millions of years ago, supposedly during a time before man had even evolved? On the other hand, the question does not present such a problem to those who accept the Genesis account of creation, for man was created in the beginning as a highly intelligent being, even capable of metalworking and other complex tasks.
Now folks, I don't know about you, but if there really was a highly advanced pre-flood civilization that was destroyed by the flood, and if the coal deposits we see today were really formed at the flood, then you'd kind of expect to find some of their artifacts encased in there from the flood. Hey, what do you know? that's exactly what we find. Shocker. It looks like people are being willingly ignorant after all, just like the Bible said. Oh, but that's still not all. The third evidence of a glorious pre-flood civilization is an amazing migration. Folks, not only do we find evidence of an amazing pre-flood technology, and their pre-flood artifacts, but just like you'd expect if they really had this kind of technology, we also find an amazing worldwide migration. As was discussed earlier, after the flood, we have the Tower of Babel incident where the whole world at that time was unified as one but were once again rebellious to God, so he confused their languages, and they were then subsequently scattered all over the world as mentioned in the account concerning Peleg when the world was divided. In fact, when it comes to the name Peleg, there's much more going on than meets the eye as this article shares. The Bible uses the Hebrew word Peleg as a verb three times. Two usages, mentioned above, are translated simply as divided, Genesis 10:25 and I Chronicles 1:19. The third uses a division by water, Job 38:25. In the 10 instances where Peleg is a common noun, it always involves water. The New American Standard Bible translates it 8 times as streams, once as stream, and once as channels. Therefore, Peleg may imply a division by water. In English, we have the words archipelago, a sea having, or dividing, many islands, and pelagic, relating to or living in the sea. Pelagic sediments or deposits are sediments on the ocean floor. Pelagic frequently refers to life forms found in the sea. Bathypelagic means relating to or living in the deep sea. Also, the prefix pelag means sea. Dr. Bernard Northrup, a Hebrew professor, has shown that Peleg originally meant division by water. That meaning is embedded in all three language families of Noah's offspring. Consequently, its meaning probably preceded the multiplication of languages at Babel. Therefore, the earth was probably divided by water in Peleg's day. The hydroplate theory explains how and why. Soon after the flood, sea level was lower than today, but eventually, sea level approached today's level. With sea level much lower for a few centuries after the flood, imagine how many migration paths existed for animals and man to populate today's continents and islands. God's commands, Genesis 9:1, 11-4-9, for humans and animals to populate the whole earth after the flood must have been doable. If, after the flood, sea level was where it is today, repopulating the whole earth would have been difficult, if not impossible, for those first receiving God's command. The wisdom and urgency of God's command are apparent when we realize that sea level was steadily rising. The window of opportunity for global migration was disappearing in Peleg's day. From the genealogies, we see that Peleg lived from 100 to 339 years after the flood, 5 generations after Noah. Therefore, Peleg, or those who named him, may have been world travelers or explorers who discovered that the earth was being divided by rising water. Certainly, Noah's early descendants knew how to construct ships, because Noah and his 3 sons built the ark. They would have had an explorer's curiosity when they realized how drastically the flood had changed the earth. Their long lifespans allowed them to pursue that curiosity and accumulate knowledge. This would help explain a remarkably accurate, authentic, and ancient map that shows islands now covered with water and the outlines of Antarctica, as it would look with no ice. The ice age would have lowered sea level about 300 feet, almost enough to join all continents. But at the height of the ice age, Antarctica and all its coastlines would have been covered with ice. Therefore, the ice age cannot explain both the visible coastlines shown on the ancient map and interconnected continents. The flood accounts for both. The hydroplate theory also shows why the flood produced the ice age. These studies point to an earth being divided by rising water in the days of Peleg. They also paint a picture of our ancestors migrating and exploring soon after the flood. So that's the question. Do we see any evidence of an amazing worldwide migration after a worldwide flood? Of course. In fact, as to be expected, they also took along with them their amazing technology and advanced building capabilities. Sorry, evolution, no ape-like knuckle-dragging beginnings here. But don't take my word for it. Let's look at the evidence. The first evidence of an amazing worldwide migration is from coins.
Roman coins have been found in Venezuela, Maine, and even in Texas at the bottom of an Indian mound at Round Rock. The mound is dated at approximately 800 AD. In 1957, by a small boy found a coin in a field near Phoenix City, Alabama, from Syracuse, on the island of Sicily, and dating from 490 BC. In the town of Hevena, Oklahoma, another out-of-place coin was found in 1976. Experts identified it as a bronze tetradrachm originally struck in Ansh, Syria in 63 AD, and bearing the profile of the Emperor Nero. In 1882, a farmer in Cass County, Illinois picked up a bronze coin later identified as a coin of Anshishas IV, one of the kings of Syria, who reigned from 175 BC to 164 BC, and who is mentioned in the Bible. In the summer of 1882, a miner in British Columbia found 30 Chinese coins 25 feet below the surface. The examined coins of this style were invented by the Emperor Huangt around 2637 BC. A Ptolemy IV bronze coin was unearthed by the late Mr. Andrew Henderson near Barron Falls, Australia, in 1910. The coin measures about 1.5 inches in diameter and is about a quarter inch thick. The coin was positively identified as Egyptian, having been minted in Bas in Cyrenaica during the reign of Pharaoh Ptolemy IV, who ruled from 221 BC to 204 BC. On one side is the head of the horned Zeus of Omen, or Ptolemy IV, conflicting info. On the other side is an eagle riding a thunderbolt, a Ptolemaic insignia. At the time Andy Henderson found the coin at a depth of 2 feet, he was sinking a fence line across an ancient Aboriginal trail. At Gordon Vale, Australia, around 1910, a second bronze coin was dug up. It was later identified as a Greek coin minted during the reign of Pierus of Ephesus, 28 BC. Rex Gilroy in 1978 identified ancient Egyptian symbols among Aboriginal cave art only miles from the 1910 Ptolemy IV coin discovery site. At Cooktown, Australia in 1969, two gold coins of the Ptolemy period about 200 BC were found.
The second evidence of an amazing worldwide migration is from pottery. Roman pottery was unearthed in Mexico that, according to its style, has been dated to the 2nd century AD. The third evidence of an amazing worldwide migration is from inscriptions.
In 1966, a man named Manfred Metcalf stumbled upon a stone that bears an inscription that is very similar to ancient writing from the island of Crete called Cretan Linea and B writing. A mysterious rock inscription found by a farmer in 1931 on his property 50 miles west of Adelaide, Australia. The carvings were identified as Phoenician by French archaeologists and reads, "Men of the Pharaoh of the City of Size. Ot of Kish." It is believed they could be a link with the lost expedition of Admiral Ott sent in search of Australia by Pharaoh Psammeticus in 663 BC. Psammeticus, who, following the expulsion of the Assyrian invaders from Egypt, moved his government to Seir, a Nile Delta town, and established the 26th dynasty, which lasted from 663 to 525 BC. Kish was an ancient Babylonian town on the Euphrates, and was the birthplace of Ot, perhaps the greatest Babylonian mariner of the day. In the early 1900s, Bernardo da Silva Ramos, a Brazilian rubber tapper working in the Amazon jungle, found many large rocks, on which was inscribed more than 2,000 ancient scripts about the Old World. Near Rio de Janeiro, high on a vertical wall of rock, 3,000 feet up, is an inscription that reads, "Tyre, Phoenicia, Badazir, firstborn of Jethbal," and dated to the middle of the 9th century BC. Near Parahyba, Brazil, an inscription in Phoenician has been translated, in part, as, "We are sons of Canaan from Sidon, the city of the king. Commerce has cast us on this distant shore, a land of mountains. We set sacrificed the youth for the exalted gods and goddesses in the 19th year of Hiram, our mighty king. We embarked from Ezion Geber into the Red Sea and voyaged with 10 ships. We were at sea together for 2 years around the land belonging to Ham, Africa, but were separated by a storm lit from the hand of Baal, and we were no longer with our companions. So we have come here, 12 men and 3 women, on a shore which I, the Admiral, control. But auspiciously may the gods and goddesses favor us." The Kensington Stone, discovered in Kensington, Minnesota in 1898, contains an inscription describing an expedition of Norsemen into the interior of what is now North America. It's estimated that this expedition took place in the 1300s. In 1980, P. PM Leonard and J.L. Glenn, from the Hogel Zoological Gardens, Salt Lake City, visited a rock outcropping in Colorado that was reputed to be inscribed with peculiar markings. Leonard and Glenn believe they are excellent examples of Cynsain Ogham writing, a type ascribed to ancient Celts. One of the many inscriptions was translated as Route Guide. To the west is the frontier town with standing stones as boundary markers. A fist-sized, round stone was found during the early 1890s in a cemetery near Nashville, Tennessee. Its front was inscribed with symbols thought to be Libyan, pre-100 AD style. It translates as, "The colonists pledged to redeem." Ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs have been found in New South Wales, Australia. Located on a rock cliff in the National Park Forest of the Hunter Valley, north of Sydney, the enigmatic carvings have been known since the early 1900s. There are more than 250 carvings of familiar Egyptian gods and symbols, including a life-sized engraving of the god Anubis. The hieroglyphs tell the story of explorers who were shipwrecked in a strange and hostile land, and the untimely death of their royal leader, Lord Djeseb. From this information, scholars have been able to date the voyage to somewhere between 1779 and 2748 BC. In 1889, the Smithsonian's Mound Survey Project discovered a stone in a burial mound in eastern Tennessee, which is inscribed ancient Hebrew lettering. Known as the Bat Creek Stone, experts have identified its letters as being Paleo-Hebrew dating from the 1st or 2nd century AD. Some of the letters spell out, "For Judea." An abridged version of the Ten Commandments was found carved into the flat face of a large boulder resting on the side of Hidden Mountain near Los Lunas, New Mexico. Known as the Los Lunas inscription, its language is Hebrew, and the script is the Old Hebrew alphabet with a few Greek letters mixed in. In Toowoomba, Australia, there are a group of 17 granite stones found with Phoenician inscriptions. One had been translated to read, "Guard the shrine of Yahweh's message, and gods of gods." Another inscription reads, "This is a place of worship for Ra, and assemble here to worship the sun." Ra was the Egyptian sun god.
The fourth evidence of an amazing worldwide migration is from pictures.
An experienced botanist has identified plants in an ancient fresco painting as a pineapple and a specific species of squash, both native to the Americas. The problem is, the fresco is in the Roman city of Pompeii. In Australia, an Egyptian sun disc was discovered in 1950 carved into a cliff. The carving featured the outline of a chariot, showing one of its wheels.
The fifth evidence of an amazing worldwide migration is from statues.
This 92-pound basalt rock was unearthed from a building site in Australia during the digging of foundations for a factory in 1974. The rock is carved with a solar motif with a stylistic face and aeroglyphs of serpents. Marilyn Pye bought the artifact and flew it to New York, where it was identified as belonging to the most ancient Mesoamerican culture, the Latolita, pre-Mayan, and estimated at 2000 BC. In 1933, in a burial at Calixtlahuaca, Mexico, archaeologist Jose Garcia Peon discovered a small carved head with foreign features in an undisturbed burial site. It was later identified by anthropologist Robert Heiner Gelden as unquestionably from the Hellenistic Roman school of art and suggested a date of around AD 200. In 1914, archaeologist M. A. Gonzalez was excavating some Mayan ruins in the city of Acajutla, Mexico, when he was surprised by the discovery of two statuettes that were clearly Egyptian. One male and one female, the carvings bore ancient Egyptian dress and cartouches.
They are thought to depict Osiris and Isis.
The Olmec are thought to have been the first civilized people of South America, dated to around 1400 BC. One of the mysteries they left us are 16 giant carved heads wearing helmets.
All are carved from a single piece of granite, and are as tall as 6 feet 5 inches and weigh more than 20 tons.
Many more have been found scattered across the continent, half done and left as is. The problem is that the faces are clearly African in their features.
Yet historians tell us that Africans didn't come to the Americas until the time of Columbus.
Stranger still are gods mentioned in Mexican legends which speak of tall white men with beards, the god Quetzalcoatl was one in his human form, said to be tall, white with blonde hair and beard. Numerous white people's likenesses have been unearthed in some of the oldest sites in Mexico, sometimes right beside the African heads. Some of the sites date back to 1000 BC. The obvious question is, what was an advanced, black, or possibly Asian, non-Egyptian, pre-Hispanic civilization doing in Mexico in the Americas prior to and more advanced than the Maya and the Aztecs?
No one knows where they came from, where they went, or how they moved those huge stone sculptures from distant quarries.
Traditional archaeology doesn't have the answers, but if you believe that man has always been advanced, you can see where they may have come from. As one person commented, evolutionists want so much to show a steady and inevitable progression from caveman to advancing man, but Bible believers understand that man began building cities right from the beginning.
The sixth evidence of an amazing worldwide migration is from structures.
Many stone chambers dot the New England countryside, and most archaeologists insist they are all potato cellars built long ago by farmers. Others argue that they are too sophisticated for such a mundane application. One is built into a hillside at Upton, Massachusetts, has sophisticated corbelling that follows the style of Irish and Iberic chambers. It's theorized that it was really built by Europeans around 700 AD, long before Leif Erikson. California's East Bay walls, ancient low rock walls east of San Francisco Bay, have long been a mystery.
No one knows who built them or why.
In 1904, Dr. John Fryer, professor of Oriental languages at UC Berkeley, declared, "This is undoubtedly the work of Mongolians. The Chinese would naturally wall themselves in, as they do in all of their towns in China."
The seventh evidence of an amazing worldwide migration is from pyramids. There has been discovered an amazing design correlation of the pyramid-like towers in North Africa, Central America, and East Asia. The Bible and the first-century Jewish historian Josephus gives us the clues as to why. Josephus attributes the beginnings of these types of towers to Nimrod, the great-grandson of Noah. It was believed that Nimrod led the effort in the Iraq area, placed the destruction of the surface of the planet directly at the feet of God, and vowed to construct towers of sufficient height that would preclude the possibility of submergence. He writes, "Now it was Nimrod who excited them to such an affront and contempt of God. He was the grandson of Ham, the son of Noah, a bold man, and of great strength of hand. He persuaded them not to ascribe it to God, as if it was through his means they were happy, but to believe that it was their own courage, which procured that happiness. He also gradually changed the government into tyranny, seeing no other way of turning men from the fear of God, but to bring them into a constant dependence on his power. He also said he would be revenged on God, if he should have a mind to drown the world again, for that he would build a tower too high for the waters to be able to reach, and that he would avenge himself on God for destroying their forefathers. Now the multitude were very ready to follow the determination of Nimrod, and to esteem it a piece of cowardice to submit to God, and they built a tower, neither sparing any pains, nor being in any degree negligent about the work, and, by reason of the multitude of hands employed in it, it grew very high, sooner than any one could expect, but the thickness of it was so great, and it was so strongly built, that thereby its great height seemed, upon the view, to be less than it really was. It was built of burnt brick, cemented together with mortar, made of bitumen, that it might not be liable to admit water. When God saw that they acted so madly, he did not resolve to destroy them utterly, since they were not grown wiser by the destruction of the former sinners, but he caused a tumult among them, by producing in them divers languages, and causing that, through the multitude of those languages, they should not be able to understand one another. The place wherein they built the tower is now called Babylon, because of the confusion of that language which they readily understood before, for the Hebrews mean by the word Babel confusion. So the obvious question is, why was the pyramid the shape du jour for many ancient cultures around the world? Why the similarities between the layouts of the Giza and Taiyuan complexes? Why have the Chinese been so secretive about these approximately 100 pyramids? As Drive, Clifford Piva states, the tower being constructed in Shinar was in fact a means of surviving another world inundation from God, therefore a global system of refuge from another flood was required, at least so says Nimrod. These similarities in these towers from around the world show us that, the common view of, the history of the world and mankind on this earth is in complete error. Thus, the global distribution of these kind of pyramids are in perfect correlation with the post-flood biblical account. The eighth evidence of an amazing worldwide migration is from ships.
In 1886, the remains of a shipwreck was found in Galveston Bay, Texas. Its construction is typically Roman. Indian traditions tell of many houses seen on Pacific waters. Could they have been ships from Asia? Chinese history tells a charming account of voyages to the land of Fusang. Old Spanish documents describe Oriental ships off the Mexican coast in 1576. North of Cooktown, Australia, strange Aboriginal carvings have been found depicting ships not European, bearing the Aten, symbol of the Egyptian sun god. A large ironstone slab is in Rex Gilroy's museum at Tamworth, Australia. It was plowed up by a Rockhampton area farmer some years ago. It bears a Phoenician inscription that reads, "Ships sail from this land under the protection of Yahweh to Dan." Wollongong, Australia apparently is notable for the wreckage of an ancient wooden ship similar to two found in swampland near Perth, and believed to be Egyptian.
Ninth evidence of an amazing worldwide migration is from artifacts.
A doll made of wood and wax was found deep in a well of sacrifice at Chichen Itza, Mexico, on which is written Roman script. At Ullajulla, Australia many years ago, in a 2,000-year-old shell layer, an ancient Chinese stone head depicting a goddess was found. An amberglass obelisk-shaped pin, inscribed with Egyptian characters found in a field at Australia, by John Whitehouse, in 1983. It is said to be 5,000 years old. Near the Nepean River outside Penrith, New South Wales, a scarab beetle, a familiar Egyptian symbol carved from onyx, was unearthed. Another was found in Queensland, Australia, and still another one was unearthed in Kingaroy, Australia many years ago. In 1910, people excavating for a well near Cairns, Australia, 2 meters below the surface, they unearthed an Egyptian scarab beetle made from sandstone, 90 millimeters in length, with hieroglyphics carved underneath. During the 1920s, bushwalkers in far north Australia found a stone Peruvian idol, decorated in old Castilian jewellery. On Prince of Wales Island, close to Thursday Island and 60 kilometres west of Cape York, Australia, a man investigating a cave found a huge rusty broadsword bearing finely engraved ancient Castilian designs, and was found beside a crumbling human skeleton. Nearby was a gold goblet. In June 1860, David Wirick found an artifact in the general shape of a keystone near Newark, Ohio, that is covered in 4 ancient Hebrew inscriptions translated as Holy of Holies, King of the Earth, the Law of God, and the Word of God. In November of that same year, Wirick found inscribed in a burial mound about 10 miles south of Newark, Ohio. The stone is inscribed on all sides with a condensed version of the 10 Commandments, or Decalogue, in a peculiar form of post-exilic square Hebrew letters. A robed and bearded figure on the front is identified as Moses in letters fanning over his head. Japanese explorers and traders left steel blades in Alaska, and their distinctive pottery in Ecuador. Underwater explorations off the California coast have yielded stone artifacts that seem to be anchors and line weights. The style and type of stone point to Chinese origins.
The 10th evidence of an amazing worldwide migration is from tombs. In the Mayan ruins of Palenque, a stone sarcophagus was found that is very much in the style of the ancient Phoenicians. Perhaps the most amazing suppression of all is the excavation of an Egyptian tomb by the Smithsonian itself in Arizona. A lengthy front-page story of the Phoenix Gazette on April 5, 1909, gave a highly detailed report of the discovery and excavation of a rock-cut vault by an expedition led by a Professor S.A. Jordan of the Smithsonian. The Smithsonian, however, claims to have absolutely no knowledge of the discovery or its discoverers. If this story is true, it would radically change the current view that there was no transoceanic contact in pre-Columbian times, and that all American Indians, on both continents, are descended from Ice Age explorers who came across the Bering Strait. Is the idea that ancient Egyptians came to the Arizona area in the ancient past so objectionable and preposterous that it must be covered up? Perhaps the Smithsonian Institution is more interested in maintaining the status quo than rocking the boat with astonishing new discoveries that overturn previously accepted academic teachings. Historian and linguist Carl Hart, editor of World Explorer, then obtained a hiker's map of the Grand Canyon from a bookstore in Chicago. Poring over the map, we were amazed to see that much of the area on the north side of the canyon has Egyptian names. The area around 94 Mile Creek and Trinity Creek had areas, rock formations, apparently with names like Tower of Set, Tower of Ra, Horus Temple, Osiris Temple, and Isis Temple. In the Haunted Canyon area were such names as the Cheops Pyramid, the Buddha Cloister, Buddha Temple, Manu Temple, and Shiva Temple. Was there any relationship between these places and the alleged Egyptian discoveries in the Grand Canyon? We called a state archaeologist at the Grand Canyon, and were told that the early explorers had just liked Egyptian and Hindu names, but that it was true that this area was off limits to hikers or other visitors, because of dangerous caves. Indeed, this entire area with the Egyptian and Hindu place names in the Grand Canyon is a forbidden zone. No one is allowed into this large area. We could only conclude that this was the area where the vaults were located. Yet today, this area is curiously off limits to all hikers and even, in large part, park personnel. I believe that the discerning reader will see that if only a small part of the Smithsonian Gate evidence is true, then our most hallowed archaeological institution has been actively involved in suppressing evidence for advanced American cultures, evidence for ancient voyages of various cultures to North America, evidence for anomalistic giants and other oddball artifacts, and evidence that tends to disprove the official dogma that is now the history of North America. The Smithsonian's Board of Regents still refuses to open its meetings to the news media or the public. If Americans were ever allowed inside the nation's attic, as the Smithsonian has been called, what skeletons might they find? Authorities on ancient Chinese civilization have usually considered it to have been completely isolated from European influences for millennia, a homegrown culture characterized by unique cultural and technological innovations. This classical picture of ancient China will have to be modified after the recent unearthing of mummified Caucasians up to 4,000 years old in China's northwestern province of Xinjiang. These dried corpses have the long noses, deep-set eyes, and long skulls typical of Caucasians. Some even have blonde hair. Buried along with them were textiles woven in plaid patterns strikingly similar to those of ancient European fabrics. Among the colorful woven clothing found in the mummies' graves are hats identical to ancient hats found in Austria. Some 113 such corpses have already been excavated at Kızılçöke, one of four sites discovered so far. It is clear that we are dealing with permanent settlements and not merely a few lost Europeans. The corpses are so well preserved under the arid sands that the trace of a tear still can be seen streaking the face of a child buried 4,000 years ago. The condition of the mummies, excavated at various sites since the early 1900s, surprised the scientists who first found them. But far more startling was the realization that these bodies, buried millennia ago in western China, are Caucasian. Some are nearly 6 feet tall. Tests on one mummy linked it to a European genetic group. This caused a clamor in scientific circles. Conventional wisdom has long been that Western people didn't arrive in China until the establishment of the Silk Road, about 2,000 years ago. Chinese scholars have claimed, and Western scholars have agreed, that Chinese culture evolved in isolation, apart from the influence of Europe. Besides the riddle of their identity, there is also the question of what these fair-haired people were doing in a remote desert oasis. Probably never wealthy enough to own chariots, they nevertheless had wagons and well-tailored clothes. Were they mere goat and sheep farmers, or did they profit from or even control prehistoric trade along the route that later became the Silk Road? If so, they probably helped spread the first wheels and certain metalworking skills into China. V. Mayer, a professor of Chinese at the University of Pennsylvania, has been spearheading the research on these mummies for the U.S. He asserts that, contrary to the general belief, there was a substantial two-way, east-west flow of ideas and inventions beginning at least 3,000 to 4,000 years ago. But they soon discovered that not everyone wants that information made known. Proof that Caucasians were living in the region 4,000 years ago clearly refutes China's claim of historical sovereignty there, and, more important, challenges its hold on the oil-rich province of Xinjiang. The 11th evidence of an amazing worldwide migration is from fossils.
In 1982, archaeologists digging at Fayum, near the Siwa Oasis in Egypt, uncovered fossils of kangaroos and other Australian marsupials.
The 12th evidence of an amazing worldwide migration is from languages.
There are striking similarities between the languages of ancient Egypt and those of the Native Americans that inhabited the areas around Louisiana about the time of Christ. B. Fell, of the Epigraphic Society, has stated that the language of the Atacapas, and to a lesser extent those of the Tunica and Chittimacha tribes, have affinities with Nile Valley languages involving just those words one would associate with Egyptian trading communities of 2,000 years ago. In 481 BC, Confucius had recorded eclipses in Australia on April 7, 592 BC, and August 11, 553 BC, indicating that China knew of Australia's existence. The ancient Chinese book of the Classics of Shanghai, written around 338 BC, mentions a great southern continent inhabited by fierce black people who used a strange weapon, which we now know to have been the boomerang.
The 13th evidence of an amazing worldwide migration is from maps.
In a Taiwan museum, there is a map believed to be 2,000 years old, which shows the southern coastline of New Guinea, the east coast of Australia as far as Victoria and the northern coast of Tasmania. A 2,000-year-old Chinese vase unearthed in Hong Kong in 1961 had engraved upon it a crude map of the Australian east coast.
The 14th evidence of an amazing worldwide migration is from plants.
Stone carvings of maize ears and sunflowers exist in at least three pre-Columbian stone block temples near Mysore, Karnataka State, India. The 1998 article Pre-Columbian American Sunflower and Maize Images in Indian Temples shows evidence of contact between civilizations in India and America. Indologist and ethnobotanist Shakti M. Gupta of Delhi University confirms the presence of maize and at least five other New World plants in pre-Columbian temple sculptures in India in her new book, Plants in Indian Temple Art. Temples where the sculptures of corn cobs are found are dated 12th-13th century AD. The common belief is that maize originated in Mexico and came to India by the 11th-12th century. By the time these temples were constructed, maize would have been fairly common in India. Gupta does not stop with maize, but goes on to identify sunflower, pineapple, cashew, custard apple and monstera, all New World species, in pre-Columbian temple art. There is new evidence that maize was also in China. A report showed how there's an illustration of maize in a 1,505 Chinese herbal entitled Bensao Pingyui Jingyao. The researcher deems it unlikely that maize could have diffused all the way to China in just 13 years after 1,492, and hence interprets this as clear evidence that maize must have been in China at least a few decades before 1,505. The report also shows how there's a use of the word yumi, maize, in the poem Yuvu Zashu, written by Xie Yingfan circa 1368. Two additional references, to yumaize or corn silk, appear in works dating to the 15th century.
Folks, I don't know about you, but it sure seems to me that we really do see an amazing worldwide migration of people after a worldwide flood, just like the Bible says. How about you? I mean, it's almost like the Bible has all the answers, if we would only take the time to read it. Go figure. Oh, but that's still not all. The fourth evidence of a glorious pre-flood civilization is from Astounding Cities. Folks, we not only find evidence of an amazing pre-flood technology along with their ancient artifacts and amazing worldwide migration, but not so surprisingly, we also find evidence of their astounding now-submerged cities. And these underwater cities are either the remnants of a pre-flood civilization and/or the remains of submerged post-flood cities left behind after the ice caps melted, as discussed earlier. Either way, they not only serve as obvious evidence of worldwide flood, but again, they seriously upset the evolutionary apple cart of man's supposed ape-like knuckle-dragging beginnings. The first evidence of an astounding underwater city is in America. Jacques Cousteau, eat your heart out. In Florida, workers discovered the remains of an ancient city while digging a canal between Lake Dora and Lake Eustis. The city exists far below sea level and was reported in Scientific American. Another example is the remains of a large city buried off the Arctic coast. Today this region is scarcely populated, except by scattered Eskimos, because of the Arctic's hostile living conditions. Yet archaeologists speculate that the city housed a minimum of 4,000 people. The size of the city amazes modern investigators. In January 1967, the Illuminati, the world's deepest diving submarine, of that time, discovered an undersea road off the coasts of Florida, Georgia, and South Carolina, which extends to depths of 3,000 feet and is paved with a layer of magnesium oxide. Cement is a powder made from a combination of alumina, silica, lime, iron oxide and magnesium oxide that have been burned together in a kiln. Arthur L. Market, owner of the sub, reported that currents kept the road swept clean so that it looked like a blacktop, and that they had attached wheels to the aluminate and it was able to roll along the road. As the article stated, what technology could build a long blacktop paved road for hundreds of miles that was still in good condition over 10,000 years later? The second evidence of an astounding underwater city is in Japan. In 1988, scuba divers led by Kiyochiro Aritake discovered an enormous stone structure on the seabed off the coast of Yonaguni, a small island southwest of Okinawa. The structure lay more than 75 feet below the surface. Investigation showed it was 600 feet long, 450 feet wide and 90 feet high. The locals decided it was a natural formation. 10 years later, the experts weren't so sure. The first geologist to investigate the site was Professor Masaki Kimura of Ryukyu University on Okinawa. In April 1998, he discovered a structure divided into five distinct layers and decided it had to be man-made. It is easy to see why. Underwater photographs and video footage reveal a stepped, ziggurat-like monument of extraordinary proportions. Each step is about 3 feet high with clean edges and sharp angles. There is also an archway and two parallel monoliths, among other intriguing features like drainage channels. Further investigation led to the discovery of smaller satellite ziggurats near the main edifice. Each is about 30 feet wide and 6 feet high. Each appears to be constructed of stepped slabs. Widening their search, teams of more divers found another, different monument nearby. Then another, and another. They beheld long streets, grand boulevards, majestic staircases, magnificent archways, enormous blocks of perfectly cut and fitted stone, all harmoniously welded together in a linear architecture unlike anything they had ever seen before. Divers also found what looks like a road surrounding the main structure. Not so surprising, because the site is spread over an amazing 311 miles on the ocean floor, the well-preserved remains of an ancient city. The aptly named Team Atlantis expedition, who dived to make a video documentary of the site, concluded that someone in the depths of prehistory discovered a suitable rock formation and used sophisticated engineering techniques to shape it the way they wanted. Yet, there is no known Japanese civilization that could have created them. Orthodox prehistory claims the most advanced culture in Japan at the time was small groups of hunter-gatherers. As Professor Kimura points out, there is no way they could have built or even modified the Yonaguni Monument. He believes for something of this size, some sort of machinery must have been involved. As one researcher aptly stated, here are signs of great civilizations that once prospered and raised magnificent walls, buildings and monuments. Perhaps we have acclaimed the Greeks and Romans too loudly. In fact, these findings provided the basis of Japan's leading headlines for more than a year. Yet, not a word about the Okinawa discovery reached the US public, until the magazine, Ancient American, broke the news last spring. Since that scoop, only the CNN network televised a report about Japan's underwater city. Nothing about it has been mentioned in any of the nation's other archaeology publications, not even in any of our daily newspapers. One would imagine that such a mind-boggling find would be the most exciting piece of news an archaeologist could possibly hope to learn. Even so, outside of the Ancient American and CNN's single report, the pall of silence covering all the facts about Okinawa's structures screens them from view more effectively than their location at the bottom of the sea. Why? How can this appalling neglect persist in the face of a discovery of such unparalleled magnitude? At the risk of accusations of paranoia, one might conclude that a real conspiracy of managed information dominates America's wellsprings of public knowledge. However, the discovery of other, similar structures beneath the Sea of Japan was also announced. If these prove to be similar to the Yonaguni Pyramid, they may rewrite the history of early man. The third evidence of an astounding underwater city is in Cuba. Evidence of an ancient city was recently found in depths off Cuba, half mile down, thanks to a team of Canadian and Cuban researchers. They discovered the remains using sophisticated sonar and videotape equipment. They have found megaliths of a kind you'd find at Stonehenge or Easter Island. Some structures within the complex may be as long as 400 meters wide and as high as 40 meters. Some are sitting on top of each other. They show very distinct shapes and symmetrical designs of a non-natural kind. Moreover, an anthropologist affiliated with the Cuban Academy of Sciences has said that still photos taken from the videotape clearly show symbols and inscriptions. It is not yet known in what language the inscriptions are written. Researchers commented, "It is stunning. What we see in our high-resolution sonar images are limitless, rolling, white sand plains, and, in the middle of this beautiful white sand, there are clear man-made large-size architectural designs. It looks like when you fly over an urban development in a plane and you see highways, tunnels and buildings." If the dating estimate proves accurate, it would mean that an ancient civilization had designed and erected these vast stone structures long before the wheel was invented in Sumeria, 3500 BC, or the sundial in Egypt, 3000 BC. The three pyramids on Egypt's Giza Plateau are thought to have been constructed between 2900 and 2200 BC. In fact, researchers think the city is much larger than even their sonar projections show. It may extend for several kilometers. And even more strange is the fact that when they used a submersible to obtain samples of the underwater objects, the stone they recovered from ocean bottom is very polished granite. The problem is, all of the peninsula of the northwest part of Cuba is limestone, very fractured limestone. So, geologically, megalithic granite structures are totally foreign to Cuba. But it's also not known in the Yucatan, because Yucatan is also limestone, not granite. The fourth evidence of an astounding underwater city is in India. Recently, there was a spectacular underwater archaeological find near India that could rewrite history. Local fishermen in the coast of Mahabalipuram in Tamil Nadu have for centuries believed that a great flood consumed a city in a single day. Best-selling British author and television presenter Graham Hancock took these stories seriously. So Hancock's initiative resulted in the Dorset, England-based Scientific Exploration Society and India's National Institute of Oceanography joining hands, and that's when the team made a spectacular discovery. They discovered an extensive area with a series of structures that clearly show man-made attributes. In fact, the scale of the submerged ruins, covering several square miles and at distances of up to a mile from shore, ranks this as a major marine archaeological discovery as spectacular as the ruined city submerged off Alexandria in Egypt. Underwater investigations were carried out at five locations, and at each location has shown presence of the construction of stone masonry, remains of walls, a big square rock cut remains, scattered square and rectangular stone blocks, big platform leading the steps to it amidst of the geological formations of the rocks that occur locally. Most of the structures are badly damaged and scattered in a vast area, having biological growth of barnacles, mussels and other organisms. The actual area covered by ruins may extend well beyond the explored locations. The problem is, if the estimated dates hold true, it would be a spectacular development because previous archaeological opinion recognizes no culture in India capable of building anything as such during that time. Hancock says this discovery proves scientists should be more open-minded. I have argued for many years that the world's flood myths deserve to be taken seriously, a view that most Western academics reject. But here we have proved the myths right and the academics wrong. Oh, but that's not all. Another submerged city was found in another area of India. The remains of a huge underwater city off the western coast of India may force historians and archaeologists to radically reconsider their view of ancient human history. The vast city, which is 5 miles long and 2 miles wide, was discovered by chance last year by oceanographers from India's National Institute of Ocean Technology who were conducting a survey of pollution. Using side-scan sonar, they identified huge geometrical structures at a depth of 120 feet. Debris recovered from the site included construction material, pottery, sections of walls, beads, sculpture and human bones and teeth. Again, the problem is that in that part of the world there were no civilizations prior to about 2500 BC. Also, marine archaeologists have used a technique known as sub-bottom profiling to show that the buildings were built on enormous foundations. One researcher stated about these findings, "There's a huge chronological problem in this discovery. It means that the whole model of the origins of civilization with which archaeologists have been working will have to be remade from scratch." The fifth evidence of an astounding underwater city is in Taiwan. Recently, a group of explorers stumbled, or rather swam across, a 100 meters long wall-like structure 28 meters beneath the murky waters of the archipelagos Zichi and Tungchi Islets. The mysterious underwater edifice managed to stoke imaginations across the nation because the existence of such things in Taiwan is not mentioned in history books, is not common knowledge and is rarely, if ever, the topic of TV a documentary. The rest of Taiwan may have been awestruck by the find, but the island's residents remain blasé about the events that took place on their doorstep. They've been trying to get people to believe in stories of sunken cities for years. However, the recent find is not the first such discovery to take place in Taiwan's territorial waters. In 1982, a Japanese research team discovered a 100 meters long cross-like structure in waters off of Penghu's Hajiang Island. Since then, three other underwater wall-like structures have been pinpointed by independent underwater survey teams. Researchers commented that quite possibly Asia's earliest civilization were a people who were incredibly advanced for the time, with both the know-how to create household utensils, a written language and the ability to construct pyramids and megaliths. The sixth evidence of an astounding underwater city is in the Mediterranean. An ancient megalithic temple was discovered underwater off the island of Malta that some linked to the flood of Noah. Malta, a rocky island situated in the Mediterranean between the tip of Italy and the coast of Africa, had posed an archaeological enigma since the unearthing, earlier this century, of a series of megalithic structures older than any other in Europe. According to some studies, the temples may be as old as 3500 BC. The discovery of one more such temples underwater poses an even larger puzzle and may indicate a much, much earlier date for these complex and large structures, built with gigantic stones and aligned with the solstices, equinoxes or both. Dr. Hubert Zeidelmeier revealed that the temple sits on an underwater ridge about 900 by 500 meters long. The highest point, a plateau, is 19 meters below sea level. The basic diameter is about 450 meters. The temple itself will be found about 8 meters below sea level. The structure itself shows the same characteristics as the other above-ground temples in Malta. gigantic stone blocks aligned with astronomical significance thought to be used as a calendar. The basic diameter of the interior rooms are 6 to 7 meters and some of the highest walls that are still standing are 4 to 5 meters high. There is an avenue that goes up the center of the structure, crossing the kidney-like formed rooms indicating an orientation to an easterly direction, which would coincide with the rising sun, equinoxes and the winter solstices. The main difference is this structure is underwater. Since the structure, as the others in Malta, had to be first built on solid ground, its present underwater could result from either the sinking, due to earthquakes, of coastal parts of the islands or from a marked rise in the sea level due to an immense flooding. Dr. Zeidelmeyer adheres to the second possibility and wonders whether the cause was the great flood described in the Bible and in the lore of many ancient peoples, the so-called Noah's flood. He is inclined to this explanation because the west sidewall of the structure is more overgrown by sea grass than the east sidewall, apparently because there was more sand deposited on that side. Therefore, the stones on the east side are mostly free of sea grass. This could indicate that the destructive water flow came from the west into the Mediterranean Sea, adding confirmation to theories that the water broke through the Strait of Gibraltar, filling the Mediterranean basin. A couple of big stones were lifted up and dropped down in a valley below, apparently by the destructive water flow. The seventh evidence of an astounding underwater city is in the Atlantic. In 1966, an oceanographic research expedition led by Dr. Robert J. Menzies of Duke University aboard the vessel Anton Brunn photographed what appeared to be carved rock columns under 6,000 feet of ocean in the Milne Edward Deep, a depression that reaches a depth of 19,000 feet. A cautious Dr. Menzies admitted that the discovery of what may be the ruins of an ancient city could be one of the most exciting discoveries of this century, insofar as ruins go. Some of the columns are half buried in mud while others stand upright. Many of them appear to have a kind of writing on them. Another of the most amazing finds on the bottom of the Atlantic was reported by Captain Reyes Moraga's crew on the salvage ship Talia from Spain. They videotaped miles of pillared temples, buildings, and statues in wide curving boulevards, with smaller avenues branching out from the center like spokes in a wheel, with majestic temples and pyramids. Also, when Soviet oceanographers examined their underwater photos taken of the Ampere Seamount, they discovered what seemed to be walls, stairways, and other artificial stonework. The Ampere Seamount is 450 miles west of Gibraltar. The eighth evidence of an astounding underwater city is in South America. Mysterious Tiwanaku may be the world's oldest city, but it's also full of mystery. There is evidence that the city was once a port, having extensive docks positioned right on the earlier shoreline of the now inland waterbed. One of these wharves is big enough to accommodate hundreds of ships. According to Incan legends, Tiwanaku was built by a race of giants whose fatherland had been destroyed in a great deluge. Many of Tiwanaku's buildings were constructed of massive finished stones, many tons in weight, that were placed in such a manner that only a people with advanced engineering methods could have designed and transported them. The particular andesite used in much of the Tiwanaku's construction can only be found in a quarry 50 miles away in the mountains. The closest body of water to this seaport city is Lake Titicaca, the highest navigable lake in the world. The mystery starts with an ancient waterbed that covers an area of 3,200 square miles, being 70 miles wide and 138 miles long. The inland waterway is littered with millions of fossilized seashells. The lake also features a range of oceanic types, as opposed to freshwater marine life. Creatures brought to the surface in fishermen's nets have included examples of seahorses. Legends have persisted over the centuries that there are stone structures beneath the waters of Lake Titicaca, much the same kind as can be found on the lake's shore. The Indians of that region have frequently recounted this tradition, but until recently there has been no proof of such structures. The remains of an ancient temple have now been found below the waters. One of the explorers said, "We found what appears to have been a 660 feet long, 160 feet wide holy temple, a terrace for crops, a pre-Incan road, and a 2,600 feet long containing wall." Antonio Aguino, Bolivia's vice minister of culture, said, "All this means our civilizations have left more footprints than we had thought." The ninth evidence of an astounding underwater city is in the Bahamas. A husband-wife research team has announced the discovery of a gigantic, three-tiered stone platform lying underwater off of northern Andros Island. Doctors Greg and Laura Little began a series of research expeditions in an attempt to solve several 35-year-old mysteries. In the late 1960s, pilots photographed strange, circular formations off the western coast of Andros, many of which had the appearance of stone rings. Other investigators have spotted unusual formations under the shallow coastal waters of Andros, including one in the shape of the cursive letter E. However, no one had ever visited these sites to determine the nature of the mysterious formations. During two visits to Andros in February and March, the Littles managed to identify and locate all of the sites during an aerial survey. While Andros is the largest Bahamas island, it is almost completely unexplored and sparsely populated. Western Andros is virtually uninhabited. Long and difficult trips through mangrove swamps and shallow tidal bays were subsequently made to all of the sites. Then another experienced diver approached them and told them about an unusual stone structure he had viewed one time from a boat just after Hurricane Andrew passed the island in 1992. He told them it looked like the Bimini Road, only bigger. The Bimini Road is a J-shaped formation of large stones, lying on a sandy bottom a few hundred yards off Bimini Island. Bimini is about 50 miles from Miami and about 100 miles north of Andros. We were skeptical, Laura said, but we had to look. So the next morning the Littles went to the general area of Andros where the stones were supposed to be located. Laura videotaped the event while Greg snorkeled out into the ocean. They eventually found the strange formation about 500 yards offshore. It appeared to be a gigantic, flat stone platform made by thick, mostly rectangular blocks of stone. It appears to be composed of three flat tiers. Each tier is 50 feet wide and rises 2 feet above the level below it. The bottom tier has well-preserved 2-foot-thick rectangular blocks on its front edge. The blocks are mostly 30 by 25 feet and are lying side by side in rows. The back portion of the 50-foot-wide tier is partially covered with sand and has smaller stone blocks comprising it. Coral is starting to form on portions of it. Then the second tier starts with another row of 30 by 25-foot stone blocks. Several of these blocks are cracked and broken with seaweed growing between the seams. The rest of the 50-foot-wide tier is partially covered by sand. This leads to the third tier, which is also formed by the same type of huge stones. The highest tier has more damage, and it is partially obscured by sand and rubble. While the width of the platform seems to be 150 feet, the length remains unknown. It appears to be at least 400 yards long, but it ends in a huge pile of sand and seaweed. It does bear some resemblance to the Bimini Road, but the stones in the structure itself are quite a bit larger. Speaking of the Bimini Road, research showed that it was actually the remains of an ancient harbor with the stone formation serving as a breakwater and quay. The discovery of dozens of stone anchors there, with obvious rope grooves on them, has verified that there were ancient harbor formations in use. In 2006, an additional harbor works was found about a mile from the Bimini Road. It was cleared of sand and exposed by a 2006 hurricane, dubbed the Paradise Point Pier. It appeared to be elevated off the bottom and was constructed from piled stone blocks and also seemed to have numerous columns on its surface. In late 2006 and in June 2007, two other expeditions were conducted at Bimini. They found a line of intriguing bottom structures a few miles west off Bimini at a depth of 100 feet. The computer-assisted sonar revealed numerous rectangular features on the bottom. These formations were all aligned the same way, oriented as if they were small buildings sitting by a shoreline. They also believe that there may be columns there, identical to the columns reported at the inlet between North and South Bimini Islands. The earlier columns found at Bimini were of two types, fluted marble and cement. Then in an area about 7 miles north of Bimini, side-scan sonar revealed that the area was actually widely littered with apparently stone forms hidden under sand. They were astonished to see a triangular, well-polished slab of stone that appeared exactly like the apex at the top tip of a roof on a temple. It was about 7 feet long and its thickness is unknown. The triangular stone was embedded in sand, but they were able to confirm that it was at least 3 feet thick. After cleaning this stone of sand and debris, a beautiful, somewhat ornate slab was revealed. Several small pieces off the edge of this apex were removed and brought to the surface. It was white marble, gleaming like quartz in the sun. Several beams, some as long as 15 feet, were found, with one end disappearing into the sand. In addition, columns, polished building slabs, and many smaller blocks were found. Small samples revealed that these were of the same type of white marble. Then continuing on with the side-scan sonar, they could see that there were numerous rectangular formations on the bottom lying in what looked like a nearly straight line. The rectangular form sat at the top of a 10-foot drop-off, which led to a narrow flat area. Then it descended quickly toward the deep Gulf Stream. The sizes of the rectangular formations varied somewhat, with the largest about 15 by 30 feet, however, most of them are smaller, 8 by 10 feet, about the size of small buildings at a depth of about 100 feet. In addition, several photos show intriguing artifacts, which could be pots or amphorae. In summary, the preliminary investigation of these rectangular forms shows that they may well be building foundations. The 10th evidence of an astounding underwater city is in China.
Ancient Maya-like buildings were recently found submerged under Fujian Lake in China. In fact, Chinese television did a live broadcast on the investigation by a team of archaeologists of a group of ancient buildings in an area of 2.4 square kilometers at the bottom of Fujian Lake in southwest China's Yunnan province. Sonar surveying has verified that the buildings stretch 1,200 meters from east to west and 2,000 meters from north to south. An underwater robot transmitted TV images of divers searching the site and bringing out samples of pottery and a piece of stone carved with flower designs. 8 main buildings were found all under the water, including a round building and 2 large high buildings with floors that liken to the Mayan pyramids of Latin America. The round one is similar to a Colosseum in form, with a 37-meter-wide base and a gap to the northeast. One of the large, high buildings has 3 floors, a 60-meter-wide base and lots of small steps linking the floors. Another is even larger, with a 63-meter-wide base standing 5 floors and a total 21 meters high. A 300-meter-long and 5 to 7-meter-wide rock road connects the two buildings. The complex, located in present-day southern Yunnan province, is believed to be from an ancient civilization.
Now folks, I don't know about you, but it sure seems to me that the Bible had it right all along that the pre-flood civilization really was a glorious one. How about you? I mean, with all this evidence of advanced technology, ancient artifacts, amazing worldwide migration, and even astounding underwater cities, how can it be any clearer? Our ancestors were never dumb apes dragging their knuckles on the ground. Are you kidding me? The evidence clearly shows that they were super smart, much more intelligent and much more advanced than you and I could ever shake a stick at, just like the Bible says. And gee, that means, based on the facts, that the supposed evolutionary origins of man being a bunch of dumb apes dragging their knuckles on the ground is a bunch of baloney. Shocker. Based on the evidence, it really does appear that the pre-flood world was a glorious civilization that unfortunately refused to heed God's warning, and thus perished in their way. And people, this is why there's no reason to scoff at the idea that God already judged his creation with a worldwide flood. How about you? In fact, I'd say if you persist, then I'd say you're not only willingly ignorant, but neither are you prepared for the second judgment of God that's coming sooner than you might think. Maybe you should stop being a scoffer and instead take God up on his offer to get saved through Jesus Christ before it's too late. Isn't that what a smart person would do, right? I think so. But that's right, if you don't want to take my word for it, then please, I beg you, listen to God's.
Matthew 24:36-39. No one knows about that day or hour, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. As it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. For in the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, up to the day Noah entered the ark, and they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them all away. That is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man.
Oh people, I beg you, please don't be like the people of Noah's day so long ago. According to the Word of God, they not only turned a deaf ear to God's warnings, but they continued on like it was business as usual. Like there was nothing to worry about. But all of a sudden it began to rain, and suddenly it was too late. Not even beating on Noah's boat screaming their lungs out could reverse their fate. If only they would have listened to God before it was too late. And so I ask you, what's it going to take for you two to stop being a scoffer and instead take God up on his offer to get saved through Jesus Christ, before it's too late? As you saw in this study, God's been merciful. He's given us the evidence of a glorious civilization to show us he judged the world once, he's going to do it again. And therefore, I beg you, like Noah did with the people of his day, please, please, won't you turn from your wicked ways? Won't you get right with God? Won't you escape the wrath to come? Won't you come into the ark? Please, this is not a game. Time is running out. The rain is going to be here before you know it, but then it'll be too late. Please, won't you accept God's offer to get saved before it's too late? And yet the Bible says that because the people of that day refused to listen to Noah, they all likewise perished. As it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be at the coming of the Son of Man. How about you? Are you ready? Or will you likewise perish?